Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and now when it comes to vaccinations, you can reach out and touch someone. You don't have to worry about sites. You don't have to worry about hours. They're coming to you to get to Biden's magic number, so said spokesperson Jen Psaki yesterday.
The president will outline five areas his team is focused on to get more Americans vaccinated. One, targeted community-by-community door-to-door outreach to get remaining Americans vaccinated by ensuring they have the information they need on how both safe and accessible the vaccine is. Two, a renewed emphasis on getting the vaccines to more primary care doctors and physicians, something that we've seen.
Are you looking forward to getting all the information you need from your local government commissar? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.proanswerline, 64636DA, Turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, I want them to come to your door, Dan. I what would you do? Like, let's play pretend.
Yeah.
Hello? Hello? You know, are you there?
I'm looking at it as a wonderful opportunity to invite my Jehovah's Witness friend over and say, you know what? I'm interested in the information about the vaccine, but I want to introduce you to my friend. He'd like to talk to you about Jesus Christ. So as soon as you guys are done, then we can have our conversation. I tell you, I did that with the census taker. Worked wonders. Never heard from the guy again.
Never heard from him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm looking forward to doing when I'm notified that my better from the federal government will be in town, in my neighborhood, in my building to, you know, sit down. We'll have a cup of Sanka and talk about vaccinations.
It sounds like a welcome wagon on crack. I mean, this is a version of that where they welcome you in to what they want you to do with your body, and you can just have a little chat, maybe some tea and crumpets.
Well, I hear. I mean, I should say I understand that Pajamas Boy has been looking for work since Obamacare sort of went on autopilot, and so if this is a way to employ the leftist soy boys of the world, like Soy Boy Zero, Pajama Boy, then, you know, I want to do my part.
Well, here in Chicago, they have a group called Healthy Hood. Have you heard of them?
They're not.
A Latino organization group. It's mostly these real energetic interns that are going door-to-door.
I love high energy.
And Little Village. You know, they're all ready to go. They were on with Sarah Schulte, Channel 7, like, so literally on their toes, ready to hit the streets running, knocking on doors yesterday, and even taking people to vaccination sites if they need a ride.
Are they dressed as Rona Busters by any chance?
No, they're kind of, some of them are tatted up, got the neck tattoos.
Kids turning their lives around. Perfect.
Exactly. But
perfect
they're very,
program.
Again, very energetic, Dan. Here is the leader. She's a tweenager.
We know here in the black and brown communities that when that virus lets loose, it's our people who die.
So she's coming to your door. Her name's Lozano, and she's ready to go.
I had the Lozano for dinner last night with a Beaujolais. It was delicious. Can I just ask something about the black and brown communities? Uh-huh. Did I ask this yesterday, or is this just bouncing around in my head? Is the black and brown community is a black software engineer who lives in the Western burbs? Is that the same? Is he part of that community of Auburn Gresham, of Inglewood? Is it monolithic?
You did ask that question. Okay, you did. I mean, sometimes you have conversations with yourself.
I still didn't get a satisfactory answer for myself because I don't understand. These are just phrases that are used without any consideration or without any inquiry, the black mm-hmm. community, the brown community, it's all one people similarly situated who have the same mentality, the same ideas, the same perspectives. No, no. So it's and it comes to my mind when I hear some, you know, squeaky teenager telling the world about the black and brown community. She's the spokesman for the black and brown community as it pertains to vaccines. Okay.
You know what these girls remind me of? The social distance ambassadors we had last year.
Oh, yeah.
Along the beachfront. You know, had the shirts on with the shield, social distance ambassador, and the thing on the back. They're the same type of energy and the same, like, snot-nosed little kids that are telling adults what to do.
So wait a second. They come to your door, yeah. and you just have a little bit of a confab. They give you some pamphlets and whatnot.
Yeah, well, they talk to you, and they say, so if you're not vaccinated, they want to know why, and then they give you pamphlets like Jehovah Witnesses do and say, here's the reasons why the vaccines are effective. 99% of the people who have died have not been vaccinated. That's the number one bullet point.
Can you do to them what Ted Stryker did to the Jehovah's Witnesses at the airport in an airplane? No. I don't know why that came to mind.
And then if you do are interested in a vaccine, they'll schedule someone to come to your house or your apartment, or they will take you to a vaccination site.
Oh, so they will.
So you've got options.
They will do the vaccine at home.
Yeah, they will. That's a big. And if you do it at home, $50 Grubhub gift card.
Of course.
Of course, because that's the game show aspect of it all.
I want the with the Hood ambassador. What are they called?
It's called
Healthy Hood.
Healthy Hood, the Latin organization group.
I want them to go around jabbing people.
Well, they've had lots of, with all, their experience with needles because they're all tatted up.
I'm having but this trouble is an finding internship. Your vein. Yeah,
this is a resume builder here.
Oh, yeah. You know? No, I think it's fantastic. So that, that really demystifies the vaccine for me. That really, takes all the legwork out of it. And so I think that was the last hurdle to clear.
You know what?
It's just people don't have information. There hasn't been enough information put out about the vaccine. Actually, in some respects, there hasn't. We've gotten all the information they're going to put out. We don't have all the other information that we try and tackle on this show to give you the complete picture of the vaccine so you can make truly informed risk assessments and thus decisions. But
I think Hayek should answer the door. Like with
his
paw up,
the door.
Like, hello. And you put an ascot on him and come sit down.
He just like run barking to the door. And then I have to restrain him. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, that annoying little lady that you just had on the air, that's a product of DePaul, Dominion Universities, and the colleges and their activation or diversity programs. These are the people that are being hired by corporate America to satisfy the need to completely destroy the white male. So that's a serious, you should listen to that lady. Ed. She's going to go far. And another thing, if I could be serious, yesterday you were talking to Levon. And it just broke my heart.
Verlon,
the way he talked about his nephew. And cousin. You know what? Because I'm one of those guys that really didn't care anymore. I just look at the numbers on Monday or listening to you guys. And it's just statistics. And I said, wow, this is strange. But now, after that guy's nephew got shot, it hit home. It hit home hard. And I really feel for that guy. And I wish you guys would talk about that more than COVID. Because I think it is more important how the white people are actually taking advantage of these black people. They don't care at all about them, and it's just a shame they're being used. We're all being used. Anyway, keep it up.
Thanks for the call, Ed.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we were talking about this door-to-door service. Nice concierge service from the Biden administration, door-to-door to get vaccinated so they get to whatever magic number they're operating on at present. So we'll get to Chicago crime and the reaction from those civilian and police leaders in a moment. But Therese on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Dan, if I showed up at your door and you offered me Sanka, I would be out of there so fast.
Really? You want a little harder?
Whiskey, maybe?
Something from the Carnauble wagon, perhaps?
That'd be fine. That'd be fine.
All right.
Yeah, I'd stick around for that one. But, you know, just put a no soliciting sign on your door, because that's what it is. It's soliciting. They're trying to sell you something. I mean, if somebody's trying to sell you a vaccine, that's just weird.
Well, they're doing it with the lotteries and, you know, gun giveaways.
Well, here's the
F-150s.
You know, if you're a lonely guy like me and my Jehovah's Witness friend, you know, you look forward to the unexpected visit.
Okay.
Even if you open the door and somebody's, you know, plunging a syringe in your... Have you heard about the vaccine?
Oh, my God.
Pete and Racine.
Good morning. When they talk about the number of people vaccinated in the United States, along with that, and COVID is vaccinated as well. So if you add those numbers on top of the ones that have gotten the vaccination, that number is quite high of people that now do not have the potential of getting COVID anymore.
Right. Thanks for the call, Pete. And, oh, by the way, Illinois marked its first day since the start of the pandemic with zero deaths. So you know you'll get even more rhetoric from Jelly Belly and Triple Threat about COVID. And we, oh, I know we're doing really well. We got the end of the tunnel in sight. We got COVID down for the count. But we got to keep pressing, because they want to talk about that to the exclusion of talking about things like 100 shot and 18 dead over the weekend in Chicago.
Well, and real quick, zero deaths from this Delta variant. 174 people in the whole state of Illinois have the Delta variant. And it's just like the UK. I mean, there's more, you know, there was a surge in cases, but it didn't result in more hospitalizations or death.
Yeah, zero deaths is zero deaths. Pick your variant. All inclusive.
I know, but the mainstream media should stop calling it the deadly Delta variant. Every time you turn on the news, they're calling it that. It's not deadly.
It is
not more lethal than the regular COVID.
The things the big government press corps should stop doing, and particularly when it comes to COVID.
Irresponsible.
That is an infinitely long list. The things we should stop listening to, the pronouncements from Triple Threat, the latest Marxist munchkin mayor of Chicago, and her toady police chief, David Brown. They had to cobble together some kind of response to the most violent weekend in Chicago in 2021. And what do they have to offer, Amy?
Oh, that, you know, Superintendent Brown started with the positive. We took 244 illegal guns off the street. We arrested 86 people, you know, over the weekend.
At once, almost.
And we're doing well compared to other big cities. Listen to this.
Homicides in New York City are up 8%. Homicides in Los Angeles are up 24%. Homicides in Houston are up 40%. Homicides in Philadelphia are up 35%. Wait, and homicides in Chicago are up 0.56%.
Ooh.
Say that again. Homicides in New York are up.
And he repeated himself. They're cherry picking the numbers and pretending that we're stupid, that we can't figure this out. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know, it'd be interesting to have a conversation with David Brown when he could sort of take the uniform off, mm-hmm, metaphorically. And I mean his uniform as a propaganda minister, not as a law enforcement officer. So, look, we had one of the most violent years in Chicago's last 30 last year, with nearly 800 murdered, where we have nearly 400 murdered halfway through this year and more than 2,000 people shot. And he wants to tell you how good it's going as compared to other cities who've also turned their cities over to predators, over to the mob, because they have weak civilian political leadership and non-prosecution prosecutors. I mean, Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, he's the white male version of Kim Fox.
And he did go after Kim Fox.
There are too many violent offenders and too little consequences in our courts.
And then he asked members of the media a question, which was so bizarre.
We can take guns off the street. We can charge people with murder. But again, I want to ask you a question in this gallery. How many people think it's okay to have over 90 people on electronic monitoring that we've charged with murder released back to our communities? Just show of hands. Who think that's a good
idea?
Show
of hands.
For the record, no one raised their hands in the media gallery and thought it was a good idea to release over 90 people.
Yeah. Harump. Okay. So, yes, he's right about accused murderers, indicted, people indicted for murder being on electronic monitor. He's right about that.
He learned that from you.
Well, he's right about it. He's right about the problems at the sheriff's office. He's right about the problems at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to the extent that he was referencing that. He's right about the problems in Cook County Circuit Court. But he's got a bit of a blind spot, and that's the mayor's office, that's the fifth floor, and that's his role on the fifth floor. And I have a question for David Brown, going back to the statement that he made. Why is it, Superintendent Brown, do you think the violent crime rate, the murder rate, is up by those percentages in those major Democrat-controlled cities across America? Oh, by the way, Superintendent Brown, we're basically on pace for to repeat one of the worst years, most violent years in Chicago in the last 30, which was 2020. We're basically on pace to repeat that. And that does not include the fact that we're on pace to double the record for carjackings in a year, for example. And, you know, it's one of those things where you don't just look at homicides. You look at people, the number of people shot. You look at the number of people carjacked. You look at Class X felonies, generally speaking, because those speak to quality of life. By the way, you also look at what is now termed nonviolent crimes, the rioting, the looting, the criminal damage to property, the general thuggery that gets treated as misdemeanors or AO tickets, but also speaks to quality of life. David Brown, do you believe in the broken windows theory of policing? Because you're surrounded by people who don't. I'd just be interested to have him in a moment of candor where he's not just serving as a mouthpiece for the fifth floor, a fifth floor that is blinded by their own ideology to do what they can do with respect to increasing public safety. They just will not do it. And there's no way around it. It's like, well, maybe we could try this and maybe we could try this. If you don't get the main thing right, it doesn't matter what you do on the margins. And the main thing is to activate police to be as proactive as they can be, focused on people who are repeat offenders, focus on neighborhoods where there is endemic violent crime, and the state working with the state's attorney's office to remove those people from society for as long as the law allows. If you don't get that right, then you can talk about midnight basketball and you can talk about wraparound services at CPS. You can talk about it all. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you cannot control Michigan Avenue.
Well, they were outmanned. I mean, they had 400 kids.
They're not outmanned.
And they had 100 police officers.
They're not outmanned. First of all, 100 police officers for 400 kids twerking on the hood of a police car, that is not outmanned. They are on their heels. They are told to be bystanders. They're told to be scriveners. Write down in your notebook what you saw and send it over to this bureaucracy.
They arrested 61 people.
Yeah, yes. But you allow for the lawlessness. You arrested 61 people. Do you see what transpired? What an
disgusting
embarrassment that is. We've seen it over and over and over again. That is not outmanned. Yes, they may be down officers. They should have overall. But when you have 12,000 police officers and you're telling me you can't control Michigan Avenue against 400 kids that are communicating on social media, give me a break. It is not a resource issue, fundamentally. It is a mentality.
Rules of engagement
issue? It is a mentality problem that emanates from the civilian political leadership and throughout the system, throughout the city, throughout the city's administrative bodies and law enforcement. And the same thing at state's attorney and the same thing at sheriff and the same thing in the courts. Change the mentality. Don't erect a new institution. We don't need a new institution. It's not fundamentally a personnel problem. It is a mentality problem. And until the mentality in this city changes from the ground up, because the mentality is reflected in who's in those positions of authority I just referenced, until that mentality changes from the ground up, nothing will change. Period. Full stop. And you can talk round and round and round about it. And you can have all the press conferences you want and trot people out every other day. And you do your crocodile tears, you know, hug it out bull jive that you heard from Triple Threat yesterday. And it doesn't matter. It changes nothing. It will change nothing.
Well, here's it. Yesterday, Dan, I see you. It was all about the victims yesterday. And she's coming out with a special program for victims and survivors of gun violence. That's going to be announced later this week, yada, yada. That was her approach yesterday. And love.
We must continue to urge our young people to put down the guns. We have to love them. And tonight and today is about love. It's about making specific investments in our young people to show them that we care, to give them real opportunities. Right. But I'm also old school and believe what my mother taught me, which is we love them, but we also must hold them accountable. And we must also show them the way to a different kind of life.
Absolutely. It's just pablum. We love them by making public sector investments in them. I mean, is there a more government-centric statement that you've ever heard? How do you show love to a kid? Spend some of other people's money on them to, you know, midnight basketball it.
Well, yesterday was a new track that was unveiled on the south side.
Exactly. Give me a break. You know what?
For high schoolers, like, well, they're going to have to get here to this facility.
Yeah, you know what
they
we
don't
need?
Think about that.
We need, we don't have it on the south and west sides. We need a climbing wall. They have those up in Wrigley, but we need a climbing wall. We need a hiking path. I mean, are you serious? We need like an Outward Bound program for Inglewood, and then everything's going to be fine. That's how we show love to the kids. Oh, and a, you know, Outward Bound program that's run by the government, and it's just a dumping ground for idiot nephews of aldermen and so on and so forth. I mean, how many times around the merry-go-round do we need to go in this city?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
She's old school. Hilarious. Triple Threat. It's old school. Chris and Carrie.
I want to say good morning, guys, but it's just driving me insane. A couple quick points. I was listening to, I try to listen to some liberal radio, but it annoys me to no ends. But I actually heard a guy, Tom Hartman, blaming the Bush administration,
yeah,
Reagan,
sure,
Trump, Republican
yeah.
Party.
Calvin Coolidge. Yeah, right. Calvin Coolidge.
He's
the start of a silent Cal. Yeah.
He was blaming the Miami condo collapse on the Trump administration,
yeah,
and their tax cut.
The building was built 40 years ago, but it's Trump's fault.
Yeah, tax cuts took that building down. Yeah, no question. Thanks for the call, Chris. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But I mean, right, that's what you. What else are they going to talk about? They go to, you know, well, I don't really know what to say about this. Trump, Reagan, white racist Republicans, toxic masculinity.
Yesterday, the focus was, you know, the spin was there was an Iowa guy that stayed at the W Hotel who had five magazine rounds that were on the ledge overlooking Ohio Street Beach. And thank goodness a hotel worker stopped him, which I don't know what his motive was. They don't know either. He was released. He was charged and he was released on $10,000 bond and went back to Iowa.
Okay.
But I'm saying that instead of talking about the violence over the weekend, they focused on that.
You know,
like this what is going well in the city. It's all the way they spin it.
Talking about mindset and culture and upbringing, mm-hmm. I don't want to get deep into this, but if you want to get an interesting perspective, which I think is pretty, pretty close to the mark on culture, on destructive culture, read Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks and White Liberals. That's a good book to read. I think it has some insights for the current problems in Chicago and other big cities. Ron, Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. First of all,
how about those White Sox, Ron?
We're gonna be okay, Dan. If we stay alive,
can we beat Houston? Can the Sox beat Houston in the playoffs?
We got some making up with them to do. Well, and also with Boston. So we don't win one run away with that division, but we got to get a little.
Why don't you two go out to lunch and talk about
I'd
it?
Like to. I'd like to. That's the only thing fun to talk about in the city. Ron, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That sounds good to me. No. First of all, I do not care what Lori Lightfoot's mother said to her. That means nothing to me, okay? So keep that. And then she was talking about, well, hold the children accountable. What about holding you, her accountable? I'm just, you know what? This lady is absolutely garbage. Her, David Brown, all of them. All of them. So get her out of there. I mean, and you're right, Dan, you and Amy, it's always the same mentality. But this is something just so sickening and phony and disgusting about her. Just garbage. Just go away. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Ron. You know, I think it was Chicago Contrarian I saw this. Good institutional memory. Remember when Lightfoot was out in the streets and chastising kids?
Oh, yeah, screaming at kids, and he's like, why don't you go home? And the kid looks at him and goes, why don't you go home?
Yeah.
It's my favorite, right. Favorite response ever.
Yeah, and then he said to his friend, why is this little boy yelling at me? Where is she on the streets today? Where is she? The false bravado from the safety of the...
Oh, yeah,
the podium
she should have been at
City
Michigan
Hall?
Avenue Friday or Sunday,
yeah.
On the 4th of July.
Where is she?
Yelling at the kids to go home.
She has the moral standing, right?
Yeah, that's a good point, Dan.
Well, get out there and you tell those kids, you know, give everybody a spanking and send them straight home.
Yeah, well, they're twerking on a squad car.
Oh, I forgot you can't spank kids.
Oh, that's right.
Amish Texter, he's on the tin can and string hotline. Amish Texter from Huntley.
That's right. Good morning. Just imagine a little mental... picture, if you will. Let's say Sean from Elwood Park and Dan has breakdancers from Wheaton and their Chess King outfits, me and my Cavariccis, mm-hmm. and a bunch of, say, suburban boys went down Rush Street and acted like that, say, back in the 80s. Can you imagine the shape of our skulls from the Chicago PD, what they'd still be today?
Yeah.
Oh, they would have smacked us. My parents would have smacked me, too.
Well, I mean, we would get beaten up just for the fashion, and that would have been justified. Thanks, Amish. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, I wish it was possible to get Wisconsin Sheriff Clark to come here and teach our mayor and police superintendent what they need to do to make Chicago safe. They might actually listen to him.
I doubt they would. Thanks for the call, Terry, because he's a Republican. Coming up at 6:06... heard of Safe Spaces.
Yeah.
Now we will introduce you to Brave Spaces.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting development down in the Lone Star State. We didn't get to yesterday. Our friend of the show, we've had him on many, many, many times, Colonel Alan West, who moved to Dallas a few years back after he lost his congressional seat in Florida, worked for the Health Care Public Policy Institute there. I may be misidentifying the name, but he was focused on healthcare policy at a think tank in Dallas, and he was one of the most ardent critics of Obamacare over the last decade. Well, he announced he's running for governor of Texas.
Yeah, and you mentioned that yesterday to me, and is Abbott not running?
No, Abbott is running. Abbott is running.
Uh-oh.
And there's a belief, despite Abbott's most recent aggressive plays with respect to border security and enlisting other Republican governors to send law enforcement to help Texas man the border, since the Biden administration won't let Border Patrol do their job, federal government failing to do its job to provide for security at the border, state of Texas taking it upon himself, Abbott also making some more aggressive pronouncements over the last couple of months, starting with removing the mask mandate probably almost 2 months ago. With respect to COVID, of course, and but he received some criticism from conservatives for really signing on to a lot of the lockdown policies and holding on to them for perhaps longer than he should have. It's interesting. What's the West release 7-minute announcement video? here's some of the highlights. The top line is, at least at present, we'll see how long this holds up. Well, see, you know, he's not running for anyone, or he's not running against anyone. He's running for Texas, that sort of line. But here's Alan West offering his candidacy.
And attending the University of Tennessee is the legacy of being a black Republican. Our Republican Party of Texas was founded on Independence Day of 1867 by 150 black men. Its first black chairman was Norris Wright Cooney, a black businessman from Galveston. We think about the legacy of early pioneers in Texas politics, such as State Senator Matthew Gaines, who was instrumental in the founding of Prairie View A&M University and Texas A&M University. State Senator Gaines is buried at Texas A&M University. Or how about G.T. Ruby? All these men who were born into slavery, but somehow they understood the liberty and freedom that was worth fighting for and standing up for here in Texas.
You know, the reason, one of the reasons I like Alan West is because he is a deep intellect who understands this country's history, is very knowledgeable. And he provides historical context, cultural context, when he talks about public policy. And right there, that description of the history of black Republicans in Texas that very few people know.
Right. I didn't know. I just learned.
is just center cut Colonel Alan West. And I got to tell you, I don't think Abbott's done a bad job. I think he's been a good governor. He's presided over the incredible run of prosperity in Texas, magnet for businesses and jobs, essentially pushed the Texas liberty culture forward. But he's running for his third term, and I don't like to play identitarian politics, and it's not any old black Republican will do, because there's a lot of black Republican ciphers, just like there's a lot of white Republican ciphers who really have very little to add.
Right, but he's the real deal.
He is the real deal. And I think Governor Alan West in Texas brings more attractiveness to the Republican Party for black voters in particular. I mean, even if you don't like Alan West, even if you say, well, Alan West, he's not, you know, the whole Uncle Tom argument that every black Republican, black conservative gets hit with. You know, you can do that on the left, but I think that will continue to diminish in impact pending the performance of black conservatives in office. So you can do the Uncle Tom thing with Tim Scott. How's that going? It's not going to wash. Tim Scott's too good. He's done too good a job. And he takes these things straight away, like Colonel West. I actually think West does a better job. I mean, a better job than almost anybody. And so the same thing. I mean, West would clearly continue the culture, political culture in Texas, and probably put an exclamation point behind it and give no quarter in the way that Abbott did. So I don't think Abbott's a bad governor. Love to have a Greg Abbott as governor of Illinois. But in Texas, you know, they suffer from an embarrassment of riches. And so if you can do better, it doesn't offend me to challenge an incumbent Republican governor and see somebody better. I think Alan West would be better.
Governor Rahner was challenged, you know, as the incumbent. But I don't understand why Governor Abbott would be challenged. I think that this is, I don't know if he's trying, Alan West is doing this to get his name out there or to run for another office.
No,
or if
I don't
he
think
really
so.
Seriously wants to be the governor
of
Texas.
I think one thing Alan West is serious.
Okay.
And I don't think this is posturing for something else. I think this is an opportunity he sees to step up.
Yeah, but I wonder what he thinks Governor Abbott did wrong, where he could right those wrongs and be a better governor for the Lone Star State.
Well, focus on the two policies he focused on in his announcement speech. And that'll give you an indication of where he thinks Abbott is vulnerable.
And we fuel America so that we're not dependent on other nations that are our enemies, to make sure that we protect our borders, to ensure that Texas is for Texans. We have to secure that future, secure the future and the safety and security of our children and grandchildren. We cannot live in a state that is the number one state for human and sex trafficking in the United States of America. That's not how we protect our children and our legacy. Those are the things that we need to have in our leadership of this great Lone Star State.
Energy and the border, right? And, of course, you had the great energy failure during the winter in Texas that crippled the state for the better part of a week.
They're still having problems down there from that.
And that doesn't all land on the doorstep of Greg Abbott. However, when you're the governor and you have a agency that has oversight on Texas's energy grid fail so catastrophically, then you're going to rightly have to take some of the blame for that. It's too important to not have the kind of oversight that you need. You can't afford something like what occurred in Texas, a anomalous weather event, and you have the state shut down and people in dire straits. So that's a problem. And then again, the border, even though it's the federal responsibility, first and foremost, has Greg Abbott been as aggressive as he could have been, should have been, over the last 8 years? Remember, he's running for his third term. Over the last 8 years, is there the opportunity? And again, this isn't like harsh criticism of Greg Abbott, but is there the opportunity to do better? And I think, you know, we have this tendency, obviously we see this in Illinois. Oh, you know, I don't think we should remove that person. He or she has done all right. Well, what if somebody comes along who would be spectacular? You're willing to settle for all right because the incumbent is sort of inoffensive? No. Don't. These are our temporary representatives. Temporary representatives. So maybe I think Alan West would do a better job. I mean, it's not, he's hardly an unknown quantity. He's got a track record as a member of Congress that you could assess and in the public policy arena subsequently. And he's a recent move to Texas, so to speak. I mean, a decade, but there's a lot of recent moves to Texas, just like there's a lot of recent moves to Florida. So I don't think you can exactly put the sandbagger label on him. And he's very forthright about it, growing up in Georgia, going to Tennessee, maybe being a member of Congress from Florida. But it all stitches together. And, yeah, if you can do better, why not do better? I know that's not the attitude of, like, the Illinois Republican Party, but maybe it could be the attitude of the Texas Republican Party. And what's wrong with that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And West.
Yeah. Closing argument?
Close. Yeah, essentially, you know, what was the impetus to get in?
I have not been in elected political office for about a decade, but I can no longer sit on the sidelines and see what is happening in these United States of America. What is happening?
Mm-hmm. And here's Tom from Deer Park for some, you know, smarmy, tortured, anti-Trump rant against Alan West, I'm guessing. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hi, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. Alan West is perfect for today's GOP. He was once a serious guy. He was a Tea Partier. And now he's devolved into your typical GOPer. He was at the, correct me if I'm wrong, the QAnon event with General Flynn, where General Flynn said that we needed a Miramar-type coup here in the United States as they continue to deny that Donald Trump lost the election. So if that's the GOP I was once a part of, I have nothing to do with this stuff.
We don't miss you. Thanks, Tom. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, Dan. I think you're right about the issue with you know, Abbott, he's a good guy and everything. It did then good, but West, man, he's better. He's a really good guy. So for him to step up and do it, we got to have that. That would be good if that was happening all over and just have like a high quality problem, so to speak, and everything like that. A lot of, you know, having a couple of good guys instead of thugs and bums.
Yeah,
and
thanks for the call. Yeah, how about a contest that's interesting because you have two pretty good guys and two guys with pretty good records, as opposed to the normal race to the bottom, who is the, you know, who's the tallest skyscraper in Wichita kind of conversation that you have in most primaries. There's something else, too, about this, because I have to look at this through the prism of the Illinois Republican Party, since this is where I've resided for, lo, these many dismal years. I never understood the posture of party poobahs whose platform is rooted in the idea that competition improves goods and services and lowers the cost, right? That's what competition does in the marketplace. The one place we don't allow competition or we don't want competition is for our elected representatives. How do you square that philosophically? Competition is good. Competition improves. Competition steals. Competition tempers. But not competition when it comes to somebody we say should be the governor, the senator, the legislator. Don't you find that odd? Well, if you do find that odd, then you should be challenging the Republican Party officials where you live. Because for those of you in Chicagoland, one of the reasons that the Republican Party has gone the way of the dodo bird in Illinois is because it was opposed to competition within its ranks. And so rather than getting the best person, you know, the best to use the market analogy, the best product or service, in this case, the product is the candidate, rather than getting the best, you got whoever was friends with whoever or whoever was going to provide some sort of glide path for some deal for whoever. And that's how the Republican Party in this state, you know, collapsed in on itself like a dying star. Well, in Texas, by the way, Alan West isn't the only candidate announced against Abbott either, which is a problem for Alan West if you have a big multiple, field. Yeah. But regardless, the idea that you have competition, and if Greg Abbott is victorious, then he's gonna be a better candidate going up against Alan West. I'll guarantee you that, and vice versa. That's a good thing. Don't challenge this person. I like this person. Even if you like him, you should welcome challenges because we believe in competition, right? Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Good morning, guys. I want to address that pea hat caller from two calls back who tried to smear Alan West.
Tom in Deer Park.
Tom in Deer Park. I cannot stand these Cheney frauds in the GOP. You know, the Romneys, this tiny percentage of Republicans who really aren't. That was a smear. The QAnon thing was
right.
A smear.
Right.
And, just get out of the party. We're so sick of you. We're sick of people like you. We were already smeared when we were Tea Partiers. And the QAnon smear is just another Tea Party smear. So we don't need you in the party. Get lost.
Thanks for the call, Candace. I think Tom has. He considers himself a libertarian. He's not a Vichy Republican like Romney and some of the others. But he's just, been completely... He did a complete self-lobotomy on Trump. And so he just sounds like an MSNBC host, even while casting himself still as a libertarian. It's unfortunate, but hey, you know, can't save everybody.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So here's the message to Chicago, as I understand it, from Mayor Triple Threat and Superintendent Brown. So what we have in terms of the problem, systemic racism. And despite systemic racism and the Trump presidency, what Lightfoot and her team have done is heroically reduce violence. The reduction in violence would be that much greater if we didn't have all those guns coming in from Indiana. So we got Trump, we got systemic racism, we got guns from Indiana.
And certain suburbs, you said.
In spite of all of that, crime is down or it's up less than in other cities, as Brown said yesterday. And that this is something that deserves applause. Do I have that right? That narrative right? I think
yeah,
I do.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Instead of, you know, discussing ways to stop 104 people being shot, they said, well, we took 244 guns off the street. We arrested 86 people. We're doing our job. And one alderman wants to send in the National Guard, wrote a letter to Governor Pritzker yesterday, Alderman Anthony Beal. And reporters seriously asked her that question, is it now time to call in the National Guard?
There are some, unfortunately, in the city council that don't want to work collaboratively, that don't come and provide, come to the briefings, work with the police department, but do like to grandstand. And unfortunately, you all like to cover it. But I don't think I need to say any more about that.
Oh, boy.
Some harsh words.
Dismissed out of hand. I mean, it's not the first time this has been suggested, and Tony Beal's not the first alderman to suggest it. She is living in a tiny little glass house when she talks about grandstanding and being constructive. She's worked with the police, collaborate with the police. She's the one that's been running around since she was on that police accountability oversight board thingamajig that was saying the police are systemically racist and we need a consent decree so that the federal government can monitor the police, Chicago Police Department, from afar. And you see why the mess is what it is. For more on the topic, pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Anthony Beal, who's the Ninth Ward Alderman, Southside Ward, that includes,
Pullman.
Pullman and Roseland and West Pullman and other Southside neighborhoods. Alderman Beal, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So your reaction to Lightfoot essentially saying, without naming you, that number one, your idea is not worth discussing. Number two, you come unprepared and you're not looking to work collaboratively with her in the police department.
Well, let me just say that was the same rhetoric that we heard the day before the looting took place last year when the city was in total unrest. We tried to warn the mayor and the administration about what was about to happen, and we were totally dismissed. And you saw what happened to the city. And so this is just another scenario of what's going on with this administration, where all the aldermen are dismissed. We're not consulted. We're not listened to about what's going on in the community. We work with our commanders more than anybody else. I talk to my commander probably a dozen times a week about what's going on in my district. And that's the reason I know that my personnel is down in my district, and they keep taking all the personnel out of our community and sending them downtown. And that's why the communities are really left up for grabs, because we don't have the same police presence that we used to have at one point. And that's all I'm saying is, right now we're in a war. We're in a war out here in the city of Chicago. And if you're going to combat, yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Well, let's real quick. The night of the looting, you knew it was coming. She ignored your warnings, but yet you were proactive and you got the police officers from Area 2 and the commanders to protect that Walmart in your ward.
Well, that is correct. I called early, about 6 o'clock in the morning. I called the city, called the commissioners and the superintendent's office, and I told them what I needed to help protect areas in my ward, and they told me, well, we're going to have a meeting at 10 o'clock, and to discuss all of the things that we're going to roll out. I said at 10 o'clock, I said the city's going to be empty at 10 o'clock, and so I worked with my commander, which the mayor alluded that we don't talk to and we don't work collectively with, and my commander sent all the resources that I needed to protect the one business that was not looted on the south side of Chicago, which is Walmart off of 111th Street, along with the Ross and the other stores along that corridor. And so that just goes to show we know our community, and if we are worked with and if we are respected and our input was really meaningful, we could have saved maybe half the city. I'm not saying we could have saved the whole city, but we may have saved half of it, because we warned the administration about what was going on and what was coming, and we were totally dismissed. And so we're totally being dismissed again with recommendations about what we can do to curb the violence in this city. All I'm saying is let's bring in the National Guard temporarily, put them downtown, because all our every police district in the city of Chicago is giving police up to go downtown. And if you go downtown, you see police everywhere on every corner, but you see very little people. But the people in the community are being left to fend for themselves. So I'm saying let's bring the National Guard in, put them downtown, secure downtown, working along with the police, put those police back in the district where we need them the most. And if we put them back in the district, that will boost the presence in the communities where we need them the most. And then the third prong is we need to have a huge infusion of money towards violence interrupters, people on the street. We need to put people on the street that can relate to the people on the street, that can talk to the people on the street, and stop a lot of this back and forth. So this is a plan that I'm putting forward, because evidently what's going on in the city right now, we don't have a plan other than the same playbook that's not working. Let's cancel off days, 12-hour shifts. We're working our officers to the bone. They're tired. You can see the fatigue every single day. So let's give them some relief. Let's get more presence in the community. And this is a plan, again, that I'm putting forward, because right now the plan that's being put forward, whatever it is not working.
The National Guard, I mean, they would be under the direction of the governor. And so why would the National Guard be empowered by the same politicians any more than they empower the Chicago Police Department? Is it really a personnel problem, or is it a civilian political leadership problem?
Well, it's a combination of both. And right now, because I feel that we're in a war in the city of Chicago. When you look at nationally, over the holiday weekend, nationally, only 400 people were shot. 400 nationally, but 100 came out of the city of Chicago. So that's a problem.
Right.
That means we have something going on in this city that needs to be addressed. And if you have a problem like this that needs to be addressed, we need to do something drastic. This is nobody wants the National Guard. Nobody wants them in our community, in our downtown business district. But we have to do something to stop the bloodshed in this city. People don't want to come to this city now. When you look at the news nationally, nobody wants to come to Chicago. That means that's going to hurt our economy. That's going to hurt, people that are not only living here who are looking to move, but what are we doing to give people a peace of mind that, we're doing the best we can to stop what's happening in this city? The summer is just starting, and we need to do something.
So some of the neighborhoods that you represent, Auburn, Gresham, Roseland, West Pullman, Washington Heights, some of the most violent in the city, just some stats so far this year alone, 16 murdered, 65 shot, Auburn, Gresham, 13 murdered, 61 shot, Roseland, 20 murdered, 52 shot, West Pullman, 8 murdered, 38 shot in Washington Heights. You've been the alderman there for 20 years. So what hasn't happened that should have?
Well, let me just say this. Up until this superintendent started taking the police out of our area, if you look at the numbers we had last year and going back, crime was down 33% overall in the fifth district in area two. 33%. Roseland was the only community out of the 15 most violent communities they claimed was the only one out of the 15 that had a reduction in crime, because we've been able to invest over the years over $1 billion of public-private investment. We've created over 1,700 jobs in the community. So we had a downward trend, and we were working along with Chicago Cred, who were spending about $10 million with violence interrupters in our community, working with Arnie Duncan and his group. All those things were working. I was showing a reduction in crime overall in my community. This superintendent comes in, restructures everything, takes all our resources out without consulting with us, and now you see the results of that. And so all I'm saying, this superintendent needs to understand, before he got here, we were less than 500 murders before he got here. Since he's got here with his bright ideas, now all of a sudden you see what's going on in the city.
But you mentioned, too, that Mayor Lightfoot seems more concerned with the budget than with safety. Can you explain?
Oh, absolutely. We haven't hired any police, over the last 2 years. And a lot of people don't realize if you don't hire police, you're saving overall in the budget. There were 600 police positions in the police budget that were eliminated in last year's budget. That stuff is being swept under the rug where people don't realize what's happening. So there was systemically or strategically 600 positions eliminated out of the police's budget in order to save money overall. We're not hiring police. We're saying we're blaming it on COVID. Well, you could have put people in a bubble and put them in the academy. if the NBA could have still had their season being in a bubble, if we needed police in a large level, we could have put police in a bubble. We were already renting half the hotels downtown because we thought COVID was, we were going to need the hotels. We could have put people in the academy in a bubble and put them up in a hotel while we're getting them through the academy. We could have been, we didn't think outside the box. And so and that's what's frustrating. We spend $66 million redoing McCormick and only 28 people went through McCormick. That was a huge waste of resources. But again, when you're not listened to, when you're not respected, when you're talked down to, when you're called names and totally dismissed at every level, this is what you get.
Hey, well,
this is
well,
what you get.
Welcome to the party, Tony Beal. Called names, dismissed. So what about systemic racism? The police are systemically racist, according to Lightfoot, the city, the state, the country.
She's not respected Western, because she's a lesbian.
The Western woman. Hemisphere is systemically racist. What about the systemic racist argument?
Well, let me just say this. This is classic Donald Trump playbook. Let me blurt stuff out, get you all off looking over left so you don't look over what's going on over on the right side. And that's exactly what this administration continues to do. Blurt stuff out to get the attention off of the real substance about what's going on. And with the real substance of what's going on is the inability, not capable of running this city.
So would you support a no confidence vote in Mayor Lightfoot and Chief Brown?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had that teed up last week at the last city council meeting, but we withdrew it because the superintendent was he came before the body at the special meeting. And under my questioning for the superintendent, I'm giving him suggestions about what's going on. And he's looking up at the sky, totally dismissing me, rolling his eyes. And then he says, well, he tells me, I'm trying to keep from laughing. There's nothing funny about this.
What about your What about your constituents? Obviously, you represent a majority black ward. What do they say about Lightfoot? She spends a lot of time talking about black and brown people, talking about identity politics. How's that playing?
Well, let me just say, I was one of the first five aldermen in the city of Chicago that supported this mayor. And so when you talk about, somebody who, really gave this administration a chance, really tried to embrace this administration. And when you saw all the things that happened when this administration came in, it all started at inauguration. When, all of a sudden we were told that we're going to take the alderman's authority away from him. We're not going to listen to the alderman. We're going to just continue to do what we need to do and not worry about, what the aldermen want. And it's a new day. Well, how's that working for you?
And they had a big opening of the new indoor track facility yesterday in Gately Park, but you weren't there, Alderman Beal. Why not?
Well, the Gately Park is not in my ward, and it's just on the outside of my ward. And Michelle Harris did a great job working with Rahm Emanuel to get that facility up and running. That was a $60 million facility that, Alderman Harris. And let me tell you, Rahm Emanuel was a big driving force to get that that track up and going. He talked to Melanie Hopkins and got the first $10 million and got, I think, $40 million from the state. I think he did a wonderful job, getting that facility up and going. And unfortunately, it is a great facility, but it's not in my ward.
Mm. You've been around for a minute, as I mentioned, 20 years as alderman. And
you're making me seem old, man.
Well, yeah,
No, you're not. You're like Amy's age. So you're not. And I would say old, but I wouldn't say young either. But you've been in the city all your life. Roseland is an interesting story. Roseland today wasn't always that way. And I wonder if you look back at what Roseland was even 40 years ago and what mm-hmm. it is today and some of the other neighborhoods on the South Side, too. What do you think happened? What were the policy choices that led to the destruction of some of these neighborhoods?
Well, when you look at what happened historically, malls came into the area where you had the big shopping malls. And now you see big shopping malls are not even working anymore. because now you have the Amazon and you have the Walmart and the Target of the world. And so over time, when you have business districts where people shop and then things change and evolve, you have certain areas that become basically deserts because of the transition. So Roseland went through a transition, and nothing was done over the years to stop the transition or to adjust to the transition. And so
what preempted the transition, would you say? Because Roseland, I'm referring to the Roseland when it was a middle class black community. Mm-hmm. And
So
middle income communities, black, white, or other, you don't see deserts created because you have people that are working and that have purchasing power and so forth. So there had to be something happen. There had to be an animating event. What was the catalyst for this transition?
Well, I can tell you, when the Gately's People Store left, Jewel Osco left. We had a Jewel on 103rd in between Prairie and Indiana. We had that. We had the Gately's People Store. We had different shopping stores. And over the years, those stores just went out of business. And when they went out of business, then the jobs left the area. And so when all the jobs leave the area, you really are left, struggling to have your community rebound. And that's what happened. Ryerson Steel closed down. They employed thousands and thousands of people mm-hmm. at Ryerson Steel. Mm-hmm. They left the community. And so all the shopping malls, everything that I've been able to build is on the land of the old Ryerson Steel. We purchased about 180 acres under the leadership of, Park National Bank at the time, Pullman Bank, then Park National Bank, under the leadership of David Doig over at CNI. And the bank bought those buildings, bought all that land. And that's why we've been able to bring the Walmart in, bring all the other stores in. So we have made the adjustment. And so there is a master plan that I'm working on now on Michigan Avenue between 110th and 115th in Michigan that I think will change the face of the South Side. But again, it's very hard working with this administration. It takes, working with the administration to pull off what I'm trying to do. And when you have administration that doesn't think aldermen can bring deals to the table and don't think aldermen can do development and things like that, it makes it very challenging to rebound your community.
Alderman Anthony Beal, 9th Ward, South Side. Alderman Beal, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me anytime.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't want to get out ahead of myself, but regarding the shooting that Mike Scott was reporting on, where two ATF officers and one Chicago police officer were shot. Was this like assault on Precinct 13? Was Ethan Hawke there? It sounds like they were shot at the police station.
Right. I'm trying to find out from spokesperson Tom Ahern if they were walking into the police station and it was a drive-by shooting because they later recovered a vehicle on 89th Street.
Well, yeah, suspect vehicle.
Suspect vehicle.
So that sounds like a drive-by. I mean, I don't know, but it sounds like it.
Well, clearly they were targeted, and they've all been taken to Christ Hospital. And
if that's what it turns out to be, so now you have emboldened to do a drive-by shooting.
Shooting federal agents.
Of a police precinct.
Yeah, I mean, it's happened before. It's not unheard of, but my God. Complete lawlessness in Chicago. And we're going to be on Nightly News again and World News Now again. Chicago, another black eye for them. But our thoughts and prayers are with the two agents and the police officer, obviously.
Where does this all start going wrong? Perhaps in school. I mean, first with the family or lack thereof, and then secondarily, perhaps in school. You've heard of safe spaces, and you've heard of no safe spaces, the Dennis Prager, Adam Carolla documentary. But safe spaces, that's so passe. You know what we need now in the government school systems?
What?
Brave spaces.
Oh, really? Brave. A brave buddy bench or something?
Brave spaces. This little YouTube how to create a brave space is pretty instructive. First, you'll hear from an L.A. School teacher who's fifth grade. That's her charge, fifth graders, 9 and 10-year-olds.
Not only do we have events that are constantly occurring in our society that students are very aware of, whether you are aware that they are aware of it or not, and those conversations should be happening in our classrooms.
Trust is so important. If they tell you something and they know it didn't get out into the community or the principal's office, then they know they can trust you. And they are more than willing to share more in class.
The second voice you heard is a high school teacher in South Carolina who works in an alternative school for kids who've been suspended or expelled. We'll get back to her. The fifth grade teacher, she's white. Her kids are BIPOC. What to do?
All right. So we have this word called microaggressions. Has anyone ever heard this word before? You can just
show me. I do teach at a school where most of my kids are BIPOC, which is Black Indigenous People of Color. I am always feeling uncomfortable because I grew up as a white person who never had to talk about race. That's something that as a white person and as other white educators who may be listening to this, we just have to be okay with.
Mm-hmm. She's making up for lost time. I grew up as a white person. Are you still a white person? And then you heard her beginning the tutorial on microaggression. Here's how this goes.
Okay.
Break down the word. What does micro mean? What does aggression mean? Then combine it. What does microaggression mean? And then let me add a little bit to the definition.
So let's write this in. So microaggression is a small act toward someone or something that is based in stereotypes, bias, emotion. So everyone write that in. So you can see how our words that we've been learning, like stereotypes and bias, are coming together to look at microaggressions.
Too bad Huxley's not around. She would be a great archetypal character in one of his novels. Going back to the South Carolina teacher, Sherry Revels Davis, again, who she teaches expelled and suspended kids, alternative school. And she's drawing from the book Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds, another propaganda track, all identitarian all the time. Teaching social justice, that's her charge.
The second semester is when I start bringing content in that reflects their life. And that's usually social inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Focus on social inequalities. This is where equity comes in and how you're a victim and other people are your oppressors. And then this, Reynolds's book, there's the three neighborhood rules. One of them is no crying, and she disputes that rule. You can cry if you want to. It's your party, and you can cry if you want to.
Thank you.
And the second one is no snitching. That one she takes seriously.
Really?
That has application to her classroom.
All right. Get revenge. When we talk about getting revenge, what is it that typically you think about getting revenge? You all said that you participate in some type of physical activity. If you lose, are you going to go out and get revenge?
Basically, I come back more harder.
So one of the key things we're saying is revenge usually takes a negative connotation. Now, we are going to take revenge and look at it a little bit differently in that in this class, verbally, when somebody doesn't agree with you, you're going to get revenge on them, right? And in doing so, when you get revenge, you're going to come back at them with facts. All right? You're going to come back at them strategically.
Oh, that wasn't it. But anyway, the no snitching, she says no snitching, which you heard her say at the outset. No snitching applies to this classroom, too. Oh, whatever happens in this classroom stays in this classroom. Sure, because you don't want the indoctrination to get out. And then after you're done with one of those teachers, if you're lucky enough, you can go to Vanderbilt University and participate. Maybe you're from Santa Claus, Indiana. You got a scholarship to play football at Vanderbilt.
Hey, Jay Cutler.
Right.
Thank you.
You marry Kristen Cavalieri. Your life falls apart. But you get
divorced.
Some of her money. And so it all works out. But anyway, you go to Vanderbilt and then you participate one of the best universities in the country, reputedly. And you attend workshops about inclusive excellence that focus on everyday bias and unconscious bias as part of a collaborative effort to develop unconscious bias educational opportunities for students as well as faculty and staff. It's the circle of life when you're a social justice, trained to be, indoctrinated to be a social justice activist. For more on all this, pleased to be joined again by Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University, senior editor at First Things, firstthings.com, and author of The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. That's a good rule of thumb, too. A good neighborhood rule. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
So from safe spaces to brave spaces, 2.0 when it comes to the Marxist indoctrination, identitarian Marxist indoctrination of kids starting in the primary grades.
These people are the ruination of this country. I mean, first of all, in the way they speak, someone has to give them lessons in oral presentation. This millennial tick, you know, I was raised as a white person. And I don't know. Just simply the obnoxiousness of the cadence and the enunciation is enough for me to pull my child out of that classroom. Mm. But, you know, here's the real sad thing. Dan, Amy, we have a population of low-income kids going through elementary school, middle school, high school, and they're not learning to read and write and do basic math. The gap, actually the racial achievement gap between black and white on test scores in reading and math, it closed significantly in the 70s and 80s, into the 90s. It has been stalled. There is still a huge gap between black and white and between low income and upper income. Do you think these lessons are going to help these kids be able to write a decent essay in high school? Do you think that this is building the knowledge that they need to go into a workplace and function as a member? I mean, the idea of microaggressions, what are you asking people to do? You're asking them to become paranoid. You're asking them to take the ordinary frictions of life in a pluralistic society, in a society with free speech. People annoy you all the time. I'm going to get on the bus in a minute. I'm in Manhattan right now. I'm going to be annoyed by five different people as I'm heading up First Avenue. You know, you live with it.
Yeah, but this is
a cause.
I know,
of functioning.
That was...
you are coaching sensitivity to pathological levels.
Yeah. They always say, you know, life is made of people you don't normally like, but you have to learn to get along with anyway. But this generation is being coddled and being shoved down their throat these social justice issues instead of math and arithmetics and reading and writing.
They're not happy either. I mean, this is the thing. This whole woke craze is a joyless, vindictive enterprise. These people, I mean, look, they get rid of jokes. They don't want any jokes because the joke might come at some person's expense. They are no fun. And you know what? People don't want to live in a society that's no fun. I mean, you mentioned the dumbest generation. These are people who were 15 years old in 2008, these teachers, and were living. So they could go into their bedrooms at age 15. They had their Facebook and Instagram. They had their, you know, the smartphone was coming out.
They had the video games, they had the TV going, and it was a wonderful place to be. They had all their wonderful connections. They didn't learn very much history. They didn't read very many good novels. They didn't listen to decent music. They didn't get the equipment to function as adults in the real world. And so what are they now? They're sitting there at 25 and they're resentful. They are bitter because life isn't the wonderful place that they thought it was when they had their little bedroom utopia there.
Now they're
going to make people pay for that.
Right. In addition to being joyless and vituperative, as you're describing, the other thing about that, too, the whole idea here is to be always poised to try to jackpot your neighbor, to cast your neighbor in a negative light, to hurt your neighbor. So, as is customary here, for all their really almost demonic talk of preventing hurt and loving one another, they're really nasty, mean-spirited, uncharitable people.
Oh, this is a movement with no mercy. There is no forgiveness among these people. You are going to pay for your crimes. Slavery ended quite a while ago, but hey, nope. The penance, we're not even close to finishing the penance that we need for slavery and Jim Crow. I mean, you did that athlete. Remember the athlete 2 years ago who won the Heisman Trophy? And on the day he was given the Heisman Trophy, someone dug up a tweet he wrote when he was 15 years old. That it was some gay joke or something. 15 years old, you're going to ruin the greatest day of his life. You are going to get 15 years old. But these people are ruthless. They will take any opportunity to take down someone they feel is a victimizer.
Well,
and when we're dealing with microaggressions, all of them are victimizers.
The other thing, too, you see is you cannot describe to them what they explicitly say they're doing. And this is the case of Rachel Nichols, the ESPN reporter. She makes a hot mic comment where she says this black ESPN reporter is only being signed to the NBA Finals to advance the cause of diversity. And there's a hue and cry. What are you trying to say? Wait a second. ESPN's brass says that their mission is diversity, that they're focused on diversity. They want more diverse workplace and on-air talents and so on and so forth. So all Rachel Nichols is doing is repeating what the stated position of the corporate leadership of ESPN is, and now she's got to apologize. She's taken off the finals beat because you're not supposed to call it out even when they call it out.
You know, I look in the eyes of the accusers, and when they've got someone on his knees begging for forgiveness, apologizing, I mean, can you just see the glee in the eyes of the accusers? I mean, they are intoxicated with the power of humiliating others. To preside over a struggle session, if you are a 19-year-old college student and you're black and you march with three others down to the president's office and the college president looks at you with fear in his eyes, That is a good feeling, and it's addictive as well. They want to keep doing it.
That's exactly what Shelby Steele memorialized in White Guilt at Coe College, and that's when he knew, you know, the power of race and what exactly the direction that the civil rights movement was going to go, that he ultimately decided he wanted no part of. But that's exactly. So this has been, you know, afoot for 50 years. People just taking notice of it in the last five or the last 5 minutes, but it's been going on for 50 years in college campuses, and now it's everywhere.
Well, what I want to do is when Nicole Hannah-Jones gets her tenure at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill,
oh, she's
and
going
it's a public university
which means her salary is part of open record. I want to know how much she's getting paid and how many courses, how many students she is going to have to teach each year. I will not be surprised if she makes $175,000 for teaching two or three courses. Meanwhile, you've got hundreds of adjuncts and lecturers and graduate students at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who are doing labor, teaching entire courses and getting paid $3,000 per course.
Well,
now,
well,
I
just
want to talk about how she's a victim.
Let's
talk about her being a victim.
Just updating that. So Nicole Hannah-Jones, this is great because she just played North Carolina.
Oh, she played him like a fiddle. Now she's going to go to Howard.
She's going to be the chair of, you know, like Ibram Kendi went to Boston University with some made up, adjunct institution that he's lording over. So she's going to be the night chair of, you know, racial demagoguery and gaslighting history at Howard University.
But she got a raise, I'm sure, in the process.
They did approve her and make the offer, correct?
Absolutely.
Yep, they did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, she totally
played him.
Totally played him. I mean, it was just perfect because this is. Yep. I mean, North Carolina. You're like, as you were talking about this vaunted institution. I mean, they're just pathetic. They're feeble, and someone like Nicole Hannah-Jones, a professional huckster, she smells it right away. She seizes on it and she leverages them beautifully. Really, if you like hustling.
And let's be good game theorists here and say that if the incentives are there, people are going to do it. And so this is going to happen again and again.
He is Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University, senior editor of First Things, the book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Apparently, some assailants didn't get Lori Lightfoot's message of love, chose not to hug it out, chose apparently instead to open fire on law enforcement officers, as we've been reporting. Mike Scott's been reporting two ATF officers shot, one Chicago police officer shot on the south side.
And apparently, according to two different sources, the suspect began following the officers near 119th Street and I-57, and when they got near the 22nd Police District, they shot, it could be one person or two of the assailants, we don't know. But two ATF agents shot, one Chicago police officer shot right there. They, according to Superintendent Brown, their injuries are non-life-threatening, so that's good. And Superintendent Brown's going to be addressing reporters outside of Advocate Christ Medical Center soon. The day that President Biden is coming to visit the Chicago area, and after one of the most violent weekends in the city's history, 104 shot, 19 killed, this happens. So, they're now, because there's such lawlessness, now they're hunting them down while they're at work.
It matters not to Chicago. It matters no more than it did when President Obama would come to town, who's actually from Chicago, and we would have the same sorts of stories, and there would be the same pro forma statements, and there would be the same indifferent reaction, and life would continue to descend into madness, which it has over the last decade. Moving to matters economic, I love this. This is perfect. The European Commission has proposed exempting private jets and cargo flights from the planned EU jet fuel tax.
Oh, boy.
This is perfect. That is just perfect ruling class. The fuel tax will be applied to commercial airlines.
But not to my airline.
Well, commercial airlines, and thus to commercial passengers. So, you know, the cattle that fly in steerage class. But private jets, cargo planes, you know, big business and the wealthy champagne socialists. No, they get exempted. I suspect that Biden will follow suit since he and the EU are simpatico when it comes to tax policy. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, how about that proposed exemption for private jets and cargo planes?
Are you making this one up?
I'm not. I wish. You cannot.
You can't make
they
this
They are impossible
up.
To parody.
Well, first of all, let me just say one quick thing about that horrific report you were just talking about the police shootings. I mean, I'm an economist, but it's important for people to realize that the three evils of cities that are really just destroying their inner core and their enterprise and their attractiveness for people to live and work in are, number one, taxes, obviously. Number two is horrific schools that you can't send your kids to. And number three is crime. And people will not move to a place where crime is out of control and where even the police are being shot. And until that gets, you know, done and fixed, Chicago, one of the great cities in the world, I've said this so many times, I think it's one of the 10 greatest cities in the world, is not going to make a comeback. And this is a tax. Crime is a tax, among other things, on the residents of a city. And it just breaks my heart, that story. It really does. I can't believe that people tolerate that kind of behavior.
Well, that's they've been tolerating it for a long time, and apparently the tolerance knows no bounds. But Biden is here in suburban Chicago today to tout his latest government gambits, meaning all the quote-unquote infrastructure, all that's contained in his version of the infrastructure plan. But, I mean, the tax from getting 130 countries to agree on a worldwide minimum corporate tax, except Ireland, to what you see with the EU carve out here, to what you're going to hear from Biden again today at a community college in McHenry County, your reaction?
Well, look, I think the Republicans made a horrible deal with the Democrats on that infrastructure bill. It is not a shame on you, Dan, for calling this infrastructure bill. Yes, it is a Green New Deal bill, and it's all I've read this report. It's all, you know, it's all green energy stuff. I mean, everything in it is about climate change. I mean, these people are completely obsessed. Every single decision they're making now has to do with climate change, not what's good for the economy and workers and so on and families. And, you know, so. We have three conditions that we're circulating a letter saying, okay, if Republicans are going to sign on to an infrastructure bill, it has to have three things. Number one, it has to get rid of all the green energy stuff. I mean, people want roads and they want bridges and they want tunnels and they want, you know, get rid of potholes. We all do. And that's popular. I mean, the polls show people do want the roads fixed and the bridges safe and so on. So that's maybe $200 billion out of a $1.2 trillion bill. So just concentrate on what people want, which is better roads and bridges. Number two, no more money for the IRS. No more money. Yeah. They want to spend $40 billion for the IRS. They want to, They want to hire 85,000 new IRS agents and auditors. And if you think that they're going to use those auditors to go after Zuckerberg and Warren Buffett, no. They're coming.
They're going to go after the little guys.
Of course they will. You know, and then the number three thing that's really important is that it got paid for. Look, there's hundreds of billions of dollars that still haven't even been spent because they don't know how to spend the money from the last COVID relief bill. So why don't you reprogram that money to fix roads and bridges? We can't afford another $1 trillion of debt, Amy. I mean, we are bankrupting our country with $20 trillion of new debt over the next decade.
Do you want to know how much a jug of goldfish is? Because I base inflation off of that when I go to the grocery store.
The goldfish snacks. Oh, I thought you meant the fish.
$8.25. Like okay, last time I talked to you, it was $7.99. Now it's $8.25. Just so you know, same store, same aisle.
Yeah. Well, how about the for the price of oil? You know, the barrel of oil now is $75.02. It was less than $40 a barrel when Biden became president. And by the way, I've talked to some of the experts in the oil industry, including Harold Hamm, who's the president of one of the biggest oil companies in the country, in the world, in fact. And he's saying that he thinks the oil price is going to go over to $100 a barrel. So you're talking about, you know, what are you guys paying now in Chicago?
About three, well, downtown, 340, out in the suburbs, 318 to 330.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, it's going, if we go to $100 a barrel, it's going to go well over $4 a gallon. I mean, that's going to be an almost doubling of the price of gas in just, you know, 18 months. So there is inflation out there. I mean, I've got to tell you guys, I mean, there is inflation. The worst thing now is to pass another $1 or $2 or $3 trillion spending bill that we don't have, that we're not paying for. That will inflame the inflation, no question about it. You dump dollar bills, $100 bills out of helicopter windows, that makes the dollars in your paycheck worth a lot less. Right. And by the way, how did Biden come up with this number that it's cheaper now for the 4th of July than it was last year?
16 cents.
And he's going to be here in Chicago.
How did he come up with that number? Everything's more expensive. Beef prices, the hot dog prices are more expensive. The buns are more expensive. The gas to get to the 4th of July party. Even the fireworks are more expensive.
And he's coming to Crystal Lake to talk about, you know, making college more affordable for all, ending child poverty, and positive signs in the job market.
So, you know, do you know what the Steve Moore plan is for making college more affordable?
What?
Stop subsidizing it.
Why don't we, every school that has a endowment of over $500 million, and by that includes the University of Chicago, it includes Northwestern, and probably University of Illinois as well, they should basically use that endowment to cut their tuitions in half. How about that?
That would be great.
Or you can just stop subsidizing college loans.
I mean, that too. You know, but by the way, if you cut the tuition in half, a lot of people wouldn't have to take out those loans in the first place. I mean, you know, the cost of college and the universities in America today is the greatest financial scandal. And the idea we keep giving the universities more money, how is that reduced? That doesn't reduce the cost of college. They just increase the tuition. The more loans, the more the tuition is.
Stephen, how much did you have to pay when you went to U of I? You remember?
I was paying,
back then.
Now I'm going to tell you how old I am, because back then I graduated in 82, 83. I was on the I was like a,
was
you
it
know,
82 or 83?
I was like Belushi. I was 6 years of college down the drain.
Yeah, right.
But, commit to a year.
No, I paid about, Amy, it was about $1,200 a semester.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. $1,200 a semester.
How did we let that happen?
On the quad area, you know, at the University of Chicago in Champaign, people would protest about the high tuition cost.
Right.
You know, and now it's what, $20,000? What is it now? Probably $15,000 a semester or something.
And
like
the only way you got in is you identified yourself as a Chinese national at the time. That's how you got into U of I in the first place.
By the way, you know, I know we're running out of time. I want to make a quick point. You know, in our hotline today, we have this item about now they want to make a special classification for LGBTQ. Now, look, I'm always against discrimination. I'm against, you know, people discriminating on the basis of gender or the basis of whatever, you know, skin color. But, you know, and they're going to have loan officers, you know, keep track of the loans they make to the LGBTQ. How do they know? You know, does that mean if I go into the loan office and say that, you know, I'm gay, I'm going to get a special hand up in the lending? I mean, this is crazy. Yeah, this is happening in America.
Expect a spike in people identifying as gay. That's for sure. By the way, alert listener, Amy, for your goldfish, you can go to Target and get a 30-ounce carton for $7.79.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. All right. A little comparison shopping while we're on with Steve
Moore. How many of those goldfish do you eat every day?
Well, I mean, it's for the kids, Stephen. It's for the children.
Okay.
They like to snack or graze, as I call it, through the pantry.
Steve Moore, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great week, guys. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as information is still being culled together regarding the police shooting where three police officers, two ATF, one CPD, were shot this morning on the south side. You know, this is, again, supposition based on what Superintendent Brown just said at a media briefing. It sounds like the assailant or assailants were positioned to hit those police officers. Oh. This was an undercover operation. Well, it wasn't going too well.
Yeah, they're in an unmarked car, but we all know what those unmarked cars look like. And they were essentially, to me, and maybe you too, being hunted down. And they were shot. Well, no, I mean, because there's complete lawlessness and they knew who they were. So, yeah, it was not a random shooting, as Superintendent Brown said.
But the only way you hit the car is if you're positioned waiting for them. And it sounds like they were in a sniper position above the police car as the police car was going on to 57. Is that right?
They're not telling too many details for, you know, to...
That's what it sounds like. You hit three officers. That car could not have been moving. And they had the bird's eye on that car. That's what it sounds like. And if that's so, then they knew who it was, and that was a hit on those officers.
And this is the 36th time this year that a Chicago police officer has been shot at or has been shot.
And I also, I believe that we're around, if not today, is it the 5th anniversary of those cops in Dallas that were gunned down by a sniper?
Oh, yeah. It was the first week in July. You're right.
I'm already seeing texts and traffic saying, do you think this will have an impact on Chicago? Will it have an impact on residents? Will it wake people up? What are you talking about? The systemically racist police per Mayor Lightfoot? Will it have an impact on Chicago residents' perspectives or Chicago politicians' policy choices?
Or even the president. President Biden's going to land here in a few hours.
The answer, no, it will not. Sad to say it, but it won't. Switching gears, let's assess the impact of somebody's words. Peter Dong, we played his speech to seniors at Illinois Math and Science Academy. Peter Dong is a pretty accomplished guy. Bachelor's in physics and music, wow, from Harvard. PhD in physics from UCLA. He teaches physics and I think computer science at IMSA. We'll hear from him. Here's what he had to say to seniors on the occasion of their graduation just a couple of weeks ago. This was pretty stout of heart because he criticized his employer.
And so because we allowed the fear to take over, we decided as an institution, we made the decision to turn our back on the people who needed us most, the people that we could have helped right then. And we refused to. You really shouldn't apply for that. Like, even if you agree, I understand you might be showing agreement, but like, that's not something to applaud for. What we did as an institution last April was a betrayal of our students, an abdication of our mission statement, and a mockery of the name science in the name of our school.
Wow.
I mean, honestly, I watched that about five times.
And this parting
couldn't
thought,
get enough.
This parting thought for seniors.
And you know what? Tomorrow's graduation. Congratulations. And if you see me around, I'll just clear this up right now. You're welcome to just wave if you want. But if you want to shake hands, go ahead. I'm vaccinated. Shake my hand. And if you really want to, go ahead and give me a hug. It's fine. Okay, but no more than that. That gets weird. Okay, draw the line at hugs. And you know what? I have to admit, it's possible, even with the vaccine, there's still a risk that you might be passing a fatal virus onto me. And as long as you don't do it on purpose, I'll forgive you. Because some things are worth the risk. For someone you love. See you around.
Peter Dong, science faculty at Illinois Math and Science Academy. Peter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Well, let me just tell you something, and I don't say this very often, but that speech that you made to those seniors from beginning to end was just outstanding. I mean, that was outstanding. Good for you for... let's borrow a phrase, speaking truth to power, but also giving some perspective for those seniors on the last year, some perspective that's frankly lacking. We should be offering a lot of reflection and perspective on the last year. I wonder, forget the students for a second, I wonder how your fellow faculty members and the administration reacted to the criticism that you lodged against, well, the administration.
Yeah, you know, I think actually it's not a I can see certainly why you get that impression, but, you know, really it's not actually that big a deal. What happened in our school in particular was there was reopening was planned. Something went wrong involving internal politics, a union dispute and so forth that caused it to derail and not happen. And so that's what specifically to those students I was talking about. So I would say no one particularly wanted things to go this way. Things kind of blew up out of control. So I would say, though, the next day my principal said, congratulations, great speech, Peter. And I thought that was very nice of her. And, I have not directly heard anything negative about, which isn't to say, by the way, that everyone agreed or everyone was happy with it. I'm sure they were. They just haven't told me anything about it. But I think we overstate that, I would say that I'm sure there are people who disagree with me, but I'm not sure there are a lot of people in the administration who would disagree with me because they were, by and large, the plan was to reopen the school in April. So I would say I'm sure there are people who disagree with me. No one's talked to me about it, but it was at the very end of the year, right? So I haven't had any much opportunity to talk to anyone about it. So
yeah. I think more people were with you than against you for sure. So what? But when was this a plan? Was this spontaneous, or did you plan this speech?
Oh, it was. It was not spontaneous. I worked very hard on this speech. Yeah. I appreciate Dan saying that. I thought you liked it because I did spend a lot of time working on it.
Yeah, it came. It came but through. But I mean, when you use the term mockery, whether union or the administration, I mean, these decisions don't just make themselves. Somebody made them, or somebody recanted on a plan that they had that they had said they would pursue. And so, I mean, when you call it a mockery, I mean, somebody's got to be the person that's perpetrated the mockery.
I mean, I'm sure there are some people, I'm sure, who did not like what I said. I'm not sure everyone heard it. This wasn't actually graduation. It was a senior banquet, which is the night before.
Right.
And the reason the sound was like that because it was outdoors. So most of the teachers actually weren't there. That's true. There's probably some people who are upset about it, but no one has talked to me about it. And like I said, my principal thought the speech was good.
Well, what about the students? Because you said, you know, come by, you can wave to me, you can give me a hug. Did you get those hugs?
Yeah, I got quite a lot of hugs, actually. Not a terrible number. No, I mean, I would say, yeah, I got plenty of people come by. I'm like, hey, can I give you a hug? Actually, right afterwards, this one student, like, I was, like, walking, because it's all outside, right? So I was just walking down from where the microphone was, and this student, like, runs across the field and gives me a hug, which was nice. Because I really did miss being with them, and it was nice to do that. And I think, I mean, part of the point was that we're always so awkward and afraid of what other people think that we're not how far can I go with this person? So right. I figured if they wanted to, they could at least do that.
Everybody's a little bit different. See, for me, Peter, one hug is a terrible number.
He's not a huggy.
Don't, you know, a handshake.
Don't even look at me, he says.
Away from a distance, and that has nothing to do with COVID. Here's the thing. You are a man of science, PhD in physics from UCLA. Your commentary on COVID and the choices that were made, particularly, and not limited to IMSA, but particularly with K-12 education, what is your perspective?
My perspective is that, my point here with the speech was, I wanted to, like you said, I think it was important to reflect on what happened in the last year. And I thought there wasn't enough of that. People just assuming we did the only thing we could. And I don't think that's true that we did the only thing we could, but it's certainly true that through a lot of it, there's a lot of questions. To me, the part that really happened was that the whole year, and that's what this speech is about, that the whole year is really characterized by fear. People were just, I mean, of course, afraid of the disease, but eventually over time, the fear became kind of habitual, became kind of ingrained in people, to the point that once you had a vaccine, which is one of the best, most effective vaccines that we've ever seen, a very, very effective vaccine, and once you've gotten that, people are still just as afraid afterwards as they were before, where there's no longer a rational basis for that fear. And the same, I feel like, applies to young people, especially the younger ones, I mean, younger than the high school age. people are all in fear of them, where in fact we have extensive data now that just show that for whatever reason, we don't really know why, I don't think, that the virus just has very, very little effect on young people. And so there is part of the point I made in the speech is that for people under 18, you had a higher chance of drowning, you had a higher chance of suicide, of overdose, of car accident, of cancer, of heart, and even of cardiac arrest killing you last year than you did of COVID. And so I think that after the vaccine happened, people should have said, okay, good, now we can get back to life. But we've gotten kind of habituated to be in fear of things. And so when the school said, okay, we're going to open things up again, a lot of people responded instinctively with fear. And these people are my friends and my colleagues, some of them. But I think you just get kind of instinctively afraid of everything, even if the rational basis for that fear is no longer there. And so that's what I wanted to talk about. Go ahead.
So what's the plan for next year?
Oh, yeah, plus this year is planning to open, and you know there are some. I know there are some. There the talks are going on into the details, but they are taking steps to make sure to involve people so you don't early on, so you don't have any kind of blow up or something like we did last year. I don't particularly anticipate anything going wrong with that after this year. I feel like people will probably be fine with moving on. So I don't think there's a I don't know. I don't know how good I am predicting the future. A lot of things can change. But at the moment, it seems like everything is on track to reopen as normal in the fall.
So when you say reopen as normal, because this is sort of important, I mean, Illinois Math and Science Academy could be sort of a model to overcome fear that is informing the decisions in so many school districts. Because people say, all the eggheads over at Illinois Math and Science Academy, they're doing this. So, you know, maybe guys like Peter Dong have a pretty good perspective on this. So is it going to be kids in masks? Is it going to be plexiglass? Is it going to be astronaut suits? Is it going to be normal, like pre-pandemic normal?
That part is still under negotiation, I would say. And I should tell you, I'm just a teacher. I'm not on the negotiation teams or anything. Like, in other words, no one's asking my opinion. Yeah. I gave that speech because the students vote for teachers they want to speak at the senior banquet, and they voted for me, which is an honor, and I appreciated it.
Good choice. But,
I mean, I'm not in a position of any authority or power or anything. But, I mean, people are working on it. Last I heard, they were talking about various things. My hope is, personally, that as the rest of Illinois lightens up and no disasters happen, Lord willing, that's the case, then we're able to start relaxing the restrictions that right now people are still talking about, biweekly testing and masks and stuff like that. My hope is that that will kind of relax as we see that that's not necessary. But like I said, I have no influence on that. That's my personal opinion there, but that's not, I mean, I'm not setting institutional priorities. And I suspect that, you know, they are ongoing kind of watching what the rest of Illinois looks like at the time.
Well, I don't know if you're doing what CPD is doing, or excuse me, CPS, and that's testing healthy kids during school. Are they going to be doing that?
Yeah. Well, IMSA is a residential school, right? All the students live there, making it a very special case when you're dealing with a virus because the students are all kind of packed in together. So there is no exactly in school. They're always in school. But the last I heard, they were talking about doing biweekly testing on everyone. But maybe it was just once per week, actually. So I don't call me on this. This is just there are official rules and stuff like that will come out. But that was stuff that people were discussing. Like I said, my hope is that as the rest of Illinois relaxes, as you know, entering phase five and all that, and we see no spikes in case numbers, then we will be willing to, you know, relax some of these other requirements a bit as well. That's my hope. Like I said, go ahead.
And so what was the experience at IMSA over the last year in terms of faculty, administrators getting sick, kids getting sick? What happened?
So there were one or two people we knew, like on staff, who got the virus, nothing serious, no serious cases for them. And no students I did have some students who got the virus and one who got it pretty bad. Actually, his whole family got pretty bad. They all recovered, but there was So there were some cases like that. He was coughing a lot and stuff. It was noticeable, and it took a lot out of him. Mm-hmm. And there were some other students hearing from other teachers that had that similar experience. There were some students who lost family members, older family members, which was certainly hard for them. Yeah. So it was definitely, an impact that was felt not by a majority, but you definitely would notice it.
Well, I mean, I just, again, the data here, the median infection fatality rate for people under 70 is 0.05% nationally. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when you get down to under the age of 18, it is just infinitesimal. And, I know you're just a teacher there, but...
You're a man of science.
Yeah, and you're not the only man or woman of science at the Illinois Math and Science Academy, obviously. But, you went to Harvard and you still retain common sense, which is a feat in and of itself. And so I hope that people will listen to you and will be driven by the science and the data on this, because to have kids wearing masks, to make decisions rooted in fear, it defies common sense and it defies science. I mean, look, a president who I otherwise think was an awful president of the United States said we have nothing to fear but fear itself. He didn't say we have nothing to fear but a virus. And mm-hmm. and it's remarkable to me, even people steeped in math and science are making decisions that I don't think are based in science or any legitimate basis in the data, but are based in really not even fear, politics and societal norms and what's going on in the Western suburbs and what other school districts. You're the Illinois Math and Science Academy. Feel free to lead. Feel free to set, the bar. And I hope that you'll impress that upon some of your faculty to the risk of not being invited to sit in the faculty lounge anymore.
Oh, that's okay. They can't. I have a key. They don't
Oh, good. For perfect. Yeah, perfect. But don't you, there's got to be colleagues that you hear what they're saying or hear their expressions of thought and you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I of course, it's normal to disagree with colleagues. I mean, that's something nothing new for me or for any of us. I think that what happened was that we started to accept someone being afraid as a reason to not as an excuse, like as a reason. So if you imagine in 2018, if someone said, like, I can't go into work because I'm afraid of, for example, catching the flu, because the flu can be fatal. And you're like, well, I mean, yes, it can technically, but it's extremely low rate, right? And that's that rate. And at the time, of course, have you not thought, not being in this mode, we would think that's an absurd claim. Why did you become a teacher if you were going to behave that way, right?
Exactly.
What happened was we began to accept that as a reason. And during the middle of the pandemic, that was actually fairly reasonable because no one knew much about this virus. And no one knew really what the riskiest behaviors were. So if someone said, I really want to be extra cautious, we were inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, well, that's fine. You can just do that. I think the problem is that we got used to that. So that now there's no, that now that when someone says, well, I don't want to do it because I don't feel safe, and we accept that as a reason in itself. Now, even though we now have a powerful defense against the virus and the vaccines, and we have data to back up that there is, in fact, very, very low risk, we are still in the habit of accepting, well, because I'm because I am afraid, therefore I ought to not do this, right? Because I don't feel safe, therefore it is not safe.
I take it a step further. Not only do we accept that as an excuse, we make policy based on whoever is the most afraid. Mm-hmm. And that's insane.
I made that argument in the speech that we have a kind of reversion to the most terrified person. And I think what happens is that makes sense when you're talking about a social gathering. If you're going to have a meeting and you're in, say September, when cases were starting to spike, then some people are like, I don't think that's safe. I don't want to come in. And it's okay. It's reasonable. We can zoom in. But the problem is that we kept this mindset where we allow the people who are the most afraid to kind of dictate what happens. And maybe this is an oversimplification, but I think that's this fear became the driving force in not just in schools, but certainly in schools as well, in policy decisions. And so I think that it's now that we do have a very effective defense against the virus, and we do have data showing its efficacy, we need to move on from that mindset and say, like, look, I mean, I understand you're afraid. We're happy to work with you to alleviate the fears. But, like, we now, it's no longer the uncertainty that it was a year ago. Now it's really quite clear that if you are vaccinated, you are very, very safe. And if you are young, you are also very safe.
Yeah, and zero COVID deaths yesterday in the state of Illinois, just so you know.
It's wonderful.
Zero.
It is. I wish people would accept victory, or, you know, sort of speak. Peter Dong, science faculty, Illinois Math and Science Academy. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. Continued success with your teaching career.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, a little bit more on the shooting of those three police officers, one CPD, two ATF.
One female ATF and one male. All traveling together in the same vehicle.
You know, I don't know that I have a handle, and I don't know that David Brown provided much of a handle, and intentionally so, I understand, on exactly what the situation was with the assailant and the officers. To me, it sounded like the assailant and the vehicle, their vehicle, was perched waiting for that covert car. Like, they knew who it was, and they were targeting. Like, this was a hit. I got a direct message from a police officer, CPD. The car was most likely a covert vehicle, not an unmarked vehicle. I'm guessing they were going to make a deal with the offender or offenders, and something went south. Bad guys probably didn't know they were police, but this is all my speculation. The problem is, the only way they make those shots, when they fire on that car and they hit all three officers, they couldn't have been driving. Unless they were side by side, and I don't think they were side by side. Again, based on what Brown said, it sounds like the assailant perched above the car entering 57. They opened fire.
Well, all right. So Superintendent Brown said the three law enforcement officers were fired upon while on their way to conduct a joint investigation. A male police officer, one female, one agent were shot on the northbound ramp to Interstate I-57. From 119th
right.
Street.
So they couldn't have been side by side if they were on the ramp.
They're on the north.
So the assailant or assailant, they're on the bluff and they open fire when they see that car. So they knew. I mean, that's my supposition based on that description. Anyway,
one law enforcement officer taken to Christ Medical with a graze wound to the back of the head, Brown said. And thank goodness all three of the officers have non-life-threatening conditions or injuries.
Well, that's, of course, pales in comparison to the seriousness of this. Reporters who survived the Capitol riot. Reporters survived the Capitol riot of January 6th. And this...
just disgusting.
This piece, advice.com, retweeted by Casey Hunt, who's at NBC5. Complete dingbat. Some reporters who were there won't go back into the building. A number have sought therapy to deal with the trauma. One longtime Capitol Hill reporter opted for an early retirement shortly after living through the riot. Many still aren't sleeping well.
Yeah. She said, I don't sleep like I used to, says PBS NewsHour correspondent Lisa, whatever her last name is.
And we have audio of her.
Sorry, I'm having a panic attack. I PTSD.
I mean, is there a more insufferable navel-gazing gaggle of human beings than these self-styled heroic reporters living through this and so on and so forth? Did they live through covering the riots on the streets of America's cities last summer?
They're clearly not street reporters because I'm sure it was traumatizing. One says, I don't remember just feeling unsafe in my house because now it occurred to me, like, I wonder if some protesters could be tracking me down and show up at my house.
Don't worry. You're not relevant enough in anybody's life for anybody to care to do you any harm. You'll be fine. It's just so ridiculous. I mean, they're just such bad people, bad venal, dumb people, the D.C. press corps.
Not well read, that's for sure.
For more on all of this, pleased to be joined by John Law, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, author of Gun Control Myths, as well as More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks. I was in D.C. when the thing occurred on January 6th. I seem to have survived without too much trauma. But
were you there at the Capitol? You know,
I wasn't very far away from it. I wasn't right at the Capitol, but I'm just, you know, obviously you had the Lafayette Square riot last year in July when you had 50 Secret Service officers injured requiring medical care and 60 park police. I assume that there were reporters that were covering that. And, you know, those riots, even though you had between those over 100 law enforcement injured, those were described as largely peaceful. And, of course, you had the riots when you had the January 20th, 2017 inauguration. But that's, you know, that was much worse in terms of the number of people injured. They were purposely going and trying to seek out Trump supporters that were there. Or even when you had the, you know, the Republican convention last year when Trump gave his talk at the White House and you had the people, like even senators, attacked when they were trying to leave. But none of those were viewed as serious.
I mean, these are just the most unscrupulous, unsophisticated people. I mean, you can dress them up however you want. The D.C. press corps and their regional outlets like in Chicago, they are pathetic little people. They really are. So let's not spend any more time on them. Let's talk about something else. The violence over the weekend, 230 people murdered in America over Independence Day weekend, 18 of them in Chicago. And you heard us talking about the three Chicago cops shot this morning,
horrible.
Or three law enforcement officers shot this morning. And what do we see? It's the same old story, right? Cities that have turned against the police and turned their cities over to violent predators.
You know, it's not rocket science. I mean, if you in jails across the country releasing 50% or so of the inmates, you have police having a hard time doing their job or having budgets cut. You have prosecutors like you have in Cook County there refusing to go and prosecute violent criminals. Guess what? It's not risky for them to go and commit crimes. And so they're going to do more of it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the arrest rate is right now in Chicago, but about a year ago it was 20% of murders result in arrest. Nationwide, you're talking about 64% of murders resulting in arrest. And, you know, they have all these politically correct rules that have been put in over many decades in Chicago that make it difficult for people to go and for police to do their job.
And I don't know.
I'm Emmanuel.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you heard this, but we also have 92 people who have been charged with first or second degree murder who are out on electronic monitoring because of COVID. They didn't want to keep them in jail. And so they let them go home. And guess what? Some of them have repeated crimes.
Well, that's surprising.
Yeah.
They're supposed to redeem themselves. They're supposed to be good guys and stay at home.
Hey, John, before we let you go, I have to get you to tell this story that you wrote about in the Wall Street Journal, because it just speaks to, speaking of unscrupulous and dishonest and the lengths that the left will, the gun banning left will go to. This story of you being invited to give an address at a school that didn't exist.
Now, look, I'm happy to go and debate people on the gun control movement, but they refuse to debate. The gun control groups have an agreement among themselves that they will not debate me on TV, radio, or at universities. And so anyway, but what they do is they set up something like this, where I was invited to what I thought was a commencement address, being the keynote speaker for a very large online high school. It was having an in-person commencement at the beginning of June. You know, I looked it up. They had a beautiful website there with all sorts of information on the school and pictures of smiling students and what have you. I agreed to do it, and they start changing things a little bit. I thought I was just going to give an address on kind of the advice I give my kids on how to get a career and how to be successful in your job. Just a few days beforehand, they said they wanted me to talk about background checks, and the name of the school was James Madison Academy, and they wanted me to talk about James Madison's role with the Second Amendment. And I said, well, I was reticent to do that because I've always had this rule not to give political or what could be perceived as political commencement addresses. You're going to alienate somebody, and why make them have to sit out in the hot sun while they're listening to you give something that they dislike? But they insisted. They said that's the reason why the students had picked me. So I agreed to give part of it. And then they also changed the timing. I thought I was going to be there on June 5th. They insisted that I had to come a day earlier to go and do it. So because they wanted to do filming of it to make sure everything was perfect because they were going to be using it to go and help get more students for the school. Anyway, I'm not going to go through everything, but it's just I get there, I do the speech, and because they changed the thing, it was like a 17-hour drive for me to get down there. Ugh. And, it's the next day I get a call that they've canceled it because there's been threats of violence, apparently implied that it was directed against me, which I felt incredibly bad because here you'd had kids coming from all over the country, basically, to go and do the commencement, and it was being canceled on them. Anyway, it turns out that all this was a fraud. They spent God knows how much money. It just came out recently that the advertising agency that they hired, which is based in Chicago, worked on it for months trying to come up with this idea. And, they got worldwide news attention. I give a 15-minute talk. They boiled it down to my less than a minute, completely out of context, different parts that I had, kind of reversing the meaning. I mean, you and I, we've talked about background checks before, and you've heard me say, look, everybody wants to stop dangerous people from getting guns. The problem is the current system's a mess. Biden, for example, last week says that there are 3 million prohibited people that have been stopped. And I've talked to you about the fact that 99% of those are mistakes. You know, it's one thing to stop a felon. It's another thing to stop somebody simply being named similar to a felon. But it's easy to fix. It's primarily minorities, black males and Hispanic males, that are being discriminated against. But what I said was gun control groups will fight you tooth and nail against these reasonable fixes. Well, they took out the reasonable fixes part and made it look like I was the one who was arguing against background checks being done at all. And they were the ones that were fighting tooth and nail to go in and have reasonable, rules that were there. So anyway,
it's just disgusting.
They spent a huge amount of money on this.
It's incredible, this elaborate ruse that was set up just so they could cherry pick some of your statements to attack you. I mean, it just speaks to, they're serious about this. They're serious about infringing on freedoms, Second Amendment freedoms and others. They're serious about rewriting a history. They're serious about their pursuit of political power. And boy, and it needs to be met with equal level of seriousness, it would seem. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at U.S. Department of Justice Office of Legal Policy, author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.